if you request it, paid for by the state. So that's going on. A winner has not been certified, won't be until the recount process is finished. My gut instinct is that the incumbent justice, the conservative candidate, probably will prevail. I think that's likely. He has enough of a margin there. But there are so many questions about irregularities with the election, so many challenges to it, that this is an ongoing process. It will probably take the better part of another 3 weeks. And I think the important thing to recognize, too, is that while the way our media works, the incumbent, if he does prevail in the recount, will be identified as the winner and it'll be seen as some sort of big victory. The reality is that this is a guy who just two months ago, was thought of as unbeatable, and he almost lost. It is, to my mind, a pretty remarkable development and a good lesson about what can come of these popular movements. You go into the streets, you organize outside of the standard political operating zone, but then if you bring that energy into politics, it can have dramatic impacts, almost taking a Supreme Court seat, but also winning the races for county executive positions, very powerful positions, in the largest counties of the state, in Milwaukee County, in Dane County, in Outagamie County. You had clear contests. One candidate who supported the governor's agenda, one candidate who opposed the governor's agenda. In each of those major counties, the candidate who opposed the governor's agenda was elected overwhelmingly. And so there's a lot of politics that, electoral politics has begun to play out. And the Supreme Court race is part of it, but it's important to see that whole picture.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, John. We've got another call. This is from area code 608, which I think is Wisconsin, right?
It is.
Okay, 608-850. Are you there? Hello? Area code 608, first three numbers of the phone number, 850. Anybody there? All right, we'll try the next one.
Mm-hmm.
This is area code 616. 698.
Bob Goodridge from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Great.
Hey, Bob.
Hi. My question, John, and is a little contradictory to your statement about our activity can be on the street. I'm somewhat convinced the activity has to be exclusively at the polling booth, and it's disconcerting to see Brownback making efforts to minimize registration for first-time voters. The effort, I think, should be focused exclusively on voting. A lot of my Republican friends laugh that their constituency always vote. The unemployed, the Hispanic, the black, the college students don't vote. How do we focus, I think, with intensity, as Republicans are, on voting?
Well, I think it's a terrific question, and especially coming from Michigan, which is a state where, in many senses, you're facing challenges, political and structural, that are more serious than Wisconsin. What the governor of Michigan is doing right now, especially with this very authoritarian ability to take over local governments and essentially disempower elected officials, Michigan's got a real fight on its hands. And yes, there is a huge electoral component of that. I don't disagree with you. But I do believe that that at the core of your question is the real challenge. How do we get people motivated? How do we get them excited? How do we get them to participate in the whole of our electoral process? And I have to say that here, you asked about the Republicans, I'll borrow a page from them. When they were very dispirited after the 2008 election, the Tea Party movement developed. And it was, look, there's an awful lot of manipulation of that movement by the Koch brothers and others. But the reality was that I went to a lot of those initial Tea Party rallies, and the people who were at them were genuine. They were really upset. They felt that they had the heck beat out of them at the ballot box, and so now they were kind of using what power they had, going out to rallies. The interesting thing is that those Tea Party rallies did energize the right, and they got an awful lot of people who were dispirited and maybe even disengaged, re-engaged, reconnected, and I think that fed into a good deal of their strength in the 2010 electoral cycle. So what I think is important about what we have seen in Madison and Lansing and Columbus and Indianapolis, up in Maine, what we're seeing now with a terrific big event, big turnouts of people in Maryland and Florida, other places, is a sense of how you get people engaged. And part of it is not just to do the standard electoral practice, but also to go out and to rally, to march, to you know, physically be in connection with people who share your values and also who want to make an immediate demand. And I want to give you one sense that I think that a lot of folks are starting to wake up to that. I'm writing a piece for The Nation that I think will be in not the coming week but the week after on how a lot of the major labor unions in the country are rethinking their approach to politics. The Firefighters Union just announced that they're not going to give money anymore at the federal level. They're going to move all their money into the states because they are very disappointed, frankly, with Democrats in Congress and also believe they can get a lot more bang for their buck at the state level. Service Employees International Union is looking at starting a major door-to-door organizing drive that organizes beyond their own members out into communities across the country with the eye toward energizing folks and engaging them in all sorts of ways, both for marches and rallies but also for voting. California Nurses Association doing something similar. Down the list, what we're seeing is a recognition that especially in the era of Citizens United, with the ability of corporations to spend so much money to influence our elections, we're going to have to find new ways to engage and excite people who aren't always voters. And I think the more passion is there, and frankly, I'm going to use a word that we don't use very often, the more militancy, the sense that it really is about something and that winning really does matter, the more that's communicated, I think the stronger the electoral forces of the left become. And to my sense, a lot of the unions are starting to wake up to that and adopt new strategies that I think will be more effective.
Well, I think the key strategy is that votes do trump money. With Citizens United,
yeah.
Votes win.
If we get them out, yeah. Yeah. I think you're right.
Okay, John, we have a interesting chat question. It's from Colby Concho Crozer. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that. I think I got it right. She says, I'm assuming it's a woman. If it's not, I apologize also. I'm a school teacher, and my school district is embarrassingly wealthy due to the tax revenue from the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant in our basic aid district. Even so, the administration has refused to provide any wage benefits and refuses to bargain in good faith. My question is, all caps, why? What motivates managers to work as if they are the enemies of the rank and file?
Well, you know, I wish I could get into the psychology of that, but I don't think that our amount of time is going to let us answer that question completely. But it does go to one of the real heart and soul challenges here. And I do think that it goes to this lie, this fantasy, that somehow there's not enough money, even in a wealthy school district, to provide the services, to do the things that are needed. That somehow there's this pressure toward an austerity in places where, frankly, it's not necessary. And it's something we have to talk about. I think a huge challenge in the Wisconsin struggle came early on when President Obama was asked, really one of the first nights of the struggle, he was asked what he thought about what was going on. And he said some very good things about unions. It was extremely helpful in the sense that he said, he believed that what the governor was doing looked a lot more like union busting than really a responsible act, that he was, sympathetic to unions. Oh, good stuff. But then he also said, but look, I understand what's going on because, we have such fiscal problems in this country and everybody's going to have to sacrifice. And he kind of went down the standard litany. Now, the problem with that is that we do have fiscal challenges. There's no doubt. But when you buy into the argument that the place to balance a budget, the place to, kind of rectify all of the problems that we have fiscally is on the shoulders of teachers and nurses aides and firefighters and cops and public servants, but also on folks in the private sector who are, losing benefits. benefits, losing pensions, losing pay, in fact, even seeing their jobs locked up and shipped overseas. This is just the wrong way to come at it. And I do believe that sincere people, sincere managers, have bought into that idea because they don't hear enough of an alternative vision. It's very strongly my sense that the big mistake of progressives at this point is a failure to really talk in a blunt way about where the money is and how much is available to meet human needs, to pay workers a fair wage, to make our country a lot more functional. And I think we need to get into those debates. The right has a very simple line, and that is, we're broke. We just can't do it anymore. Well, the fact is, Michael Moore, who came to Madison and on a very snowy day and marched with folks, had a wonderful response to that, which is, we're not broke. The problem is that most of the money has been locked up in the hands of too few people. And if we release some of that money, get it out of those places where it's so concentrated and really spread the wealth, we have an ability in this country to do remarkable things. We have to get more comfortable talking about that, though, and unfortunately, there's so much discomfort in America with saying, you know, I believe in a fairer distribution of the wealth because somehow that's supposed to make you, you know, the equivalent of Joe Stalin. It doesn't. It makes you the equivalent of Franklin Roosevelt. And I, you know, I will express in a measure of disappointment with President Obama for not always articulating a Roosevelt vision when I think we need it.
Thanks, John. We'll take another phone call. This is from area code 626-683.
Yes, hello.
Yes,
my name is Frank Dwyer. I'm calling from Pasadena, California.
Hey, Frank.
Thank you for this. Thank you very much for existing, nation. I have a sad question. You talked about the failure of progressives, and you talked about winning. It seems to me that the most extraordinary bailout in the last 10 years has been the bailout of the absolutely dead four times Republican Party by the Democratic Party, refusing to fight with them, legitimizing them by compromise. When this newest death of the Republican Party, because of the behavior of the governors and the legislatures in these Republican who were swept to office this last time, they've overreached so far that there is now grassroots fury at them. But it makes me sad, even as I was rejoicing, because if it's all about reelecting Democrats who are really... If we keep electing Democrats, holding our noses and voting for Joe Lieberman or Blanche Lincoln or even Barack Obama, and what they're doing is nothing that takes a smile off the Koch brothers' faces. They're not getting what they might get in these extraordinary gubernatorial overreaches, but they're getting administrations that don't really do anything major to change the downward spiral of the country. It's not really a question. It's just a comment. I mean, I'd love to be reassured. Thank you.
Well, that is a spot-on comment, and as we all know, in a call like this, comments and questions sometimes fade into one another. And let me just say to you that what you're saying there goes to the heart and soul of the moment that we are in, and it's very important that we recognize the wisdom of a great old line from Eugene Victor Debs. If I could lead you into the promised land, I wouldn't do it, because if I can lead you in, somebody else could lead you out. And we have been stuck for too long as progressives in a kind of a dangerous cycle of looking for a messiah, looking for somebody to, you know, lead us, to deliver us. I think maybe we got a little bit poisoned, if you will, by the Kennedy moment, and maybe even I'm poisoned long-term by the FDR moment, where we all kind of think, oh, if only we can get just the right person to articulate it in just the right way and elect, you know, a good Congress to go with a good president, and that'll be that. That's not how politics works. It's not how it has ever worked. And one of the things that I think has come out of the Wisconsin moment, at least for people who've been in it, and my sense is also for folks who've been in it in Ohio, especially to some extent up in Maine, where some really remarkable things are happening right now, is this understanding of the particular value of mass mobilization, of getting tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people out into the streets. That physical presence is a big deal, because in Wisconsin, a subtlety of the Wisconsin fight is that on the day that the bill was supposed to pass, 14 members of the Wisconsin State Senate fled the Capitol and went over the state line to Illinois, which Wisconsinites would see as the ultimate sacrifice. And they spent the better part of a month in Illinois refusing to participate in the process of passing this bill, thus stalling it from going forward. And I know a lot of those Democrats who went over the state line. They were not all great progressives. They were not all, you know, perfect players. What happened was they were confronted with this mass mobilization, and they had to make a choice. Were they going to be the kind of Democrats that I think our caller has just referred to, people who are so very disappointing, who are so very compromised, or were they going to refuse to be a part of that machine, refuse to be a part of the process, and try, just as the demonstrators outside were, to stop it, to prevent something very bad from happening? And they rose to the occasion. I think that this is the one thing that we take away from this. An understanding of the value of mass mobilization, an understanding of the tremendous value of getting people physically out into the streets. So you see this image of real opposition. That matters. It matters not merely from a media standpoint, but also to making Democrats, and frankly even responsible Republicans, wake up a little bit to what's going on. And I think that's one of the things that the unions are beginning to recognize. I've spoken with Mary Kay Henry, the head of the Service Employees Union, who's talking about using this power of mass mobilization a great deal more than they have for a very long time. California Nurses Association, similar, looking at it, very fascinated by what communication workers and Larry Cohen, their head, are talking about with, you know, regular demonstrations, regular mobilizations, and kind of building a politics that doesn't begin and end at the ballot box, that includes the ballot box, but also includes, you know, kind of a much more constant presence. And I do think that's the answer to your question. It is to step a little bit away from the pure electoral and the presumption that just electing a Democrat is going to solve a problem, and over toward the concept that building movements, ongoing strong movements that are physically present, that will do more to make a Democratic president or a Democratic party do the right thing than all the campaign contributions and, frankly, than all the traditional political practices.
Thanks, John. I think we've got time for maybe two more questions. I've got someone on the phone, area code 740773.
Yes, Jack Burgess here. Thank you very much. I led a strike of pin setters when I was 14 in Flint, Michigan, and I led a strike of 4,000 teachers in Columbus, Ohio in 1975. I'm 73 years old now, been active all that time, retired. We cannot stay in the streets forever, so that is not a solution to the long-range problem. We must have a coalition of progressive groups. We must have better communications. Great magazine, The Nation, love it. If it wasn't for The Nation, I'd move to France. But it's not enough. The folks in Southern Ohio watch Fox News or CNN. They listen to right-wing radio. We have to somehow penetrate. We could not get a fairness doctrine introduced in the last Congress, certainly won't get one now. We need somehow to communicate with those folks who we're not reaching. And, again, we can't stay on the streets. We're getting our petitions done. We will get our issue on the ballot. We will overturn John Kasich's law, but he will come back with another one. And we will be pounded day in and day out on Fox and right-wing radio. So, please, I call on The Nation, and I've written to you to this extent, to try to coalesce other communications groups. Talk to Michael Moore. Talk to others who have some money, have some clout, have some progressivity, and put together something, a cable station, radio chain, newspapers, whatever. We've got to reach those voters that we're not reaching. Thanks.
Well, that's a really great question. Let me come off it, because you're going right up my alley here with a passionate interest of mine, and I do think we have a very failed media system in this country. Our communications are a mess. It's not just mainstream mass communications. It's frankly a lot of the ways that the left and the progressives have kind of settled into communicating are clearly insufficient for the moment. And I will tell you that you're exactly right. We do need to look for new ways to communicate. A couple things that come off the Wisconsin fight, and also, we're talking a lot about Wisconsin. We do need to always be conscious. This is Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Maine, Indiana, and frankly, dozens of other states, because this is something that isn't just a one-state problem. One of the things that happened in Wisconsin that was a very, very big deal was that MSNBC, the cable network, committed to this story very early on, Ed Schultz in particular, to covering it on a pretty much daily basis during the thick of the struggle, and frankly, to sticking with it quite a bit, even as things have evolved out. It's a powerful lesson here. We have to make sure that our allied or friendly media doesn't just adopt the worst habits of mainstream media in general, which is to cover everything as an anecdote and then to move on to the next thing. Consistency of coverage matters a great deal. MSNBC got high marks, in my view, for a lot of its coverage there. Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Also did a good job, and very impressive. But I will say that I came away from the Wisconsin fight with a powerful lesson in the absolute essential nature of new media, social media especially. And I'll give you a quick anecdote. It's the best way to do it. And to say that as we talk about building something out, I think we have to really focus on this. Facebook was, without a doubt, the central organizing tool of the Wisconsin fight. It has been and continues to be. And I'll give you a good example. Michael Moore called me, or actually he emailed, on a very cold Saturday morning in late February, said he had decided to come to Wisconsin and he had bought his plane ticket. He was going to arrive at about noon. This was about 8 in the morning. And he said, I just want to be a part of things. There wasn't that much happening officially that Saturday. So I told a couple people, well, Michael Moore is coming. I told some firefighters. I told some teachers. And I went to pick Michael up at the airport. I also told somebody he's doing a little rally outside the Capitol. And so the word kind of came out. Michael Moore's coming. He'll be at this rally at 2 o'clock. Pick him up at the airport. We drive up. We go up to fire station downtown. Go into the fire station. The head of the teachers union, the head of the firefighters union are there to meet him. And they give him like a hat, which didn't fit him because his head's too big. And then they open the front door of the fire station, and there were 6,000 firefighters and teachers who had shown up because they had heard through Facebook mainly, and the connections that go beyond Facebook, Twitter, and also just once you hear it on Facebook, you call a friend, all that web of communication. They had gotten out there. They were all in line ready to march. The group marched off from behind the fire station onto the main street of going into the Capitol, and bagpipes blaring, Michael Moore in the front. And there were more than 50,000 people who were there. It was an amazing testament to the power of a lot of this new media. And to the extent that we harness it and make good use of it, I think it's a way to sort of take a technological leap ahead of the very challenging old media systems that, frankly, are never going to – we can pool all our money and try and buy a cable network or try and buy a couple cable networks. But at the end of the day, I do think that getting ahead of the curve on what's developing with social media is going to be very critical to this, and it is very powerful. I cannot tell you how important it has been, not merely for mobilization, but also for education. I'm blown away by the extent to which something I write for The Nation on our website ends up just going through this incredible web of communications where ordinary folks are clicking and connecting.
John, am I still on the air? Can I? You're absolutely right, but there are hundreds of thousands, millions of older people who will not be on unless you want to wait till they all die off. And some of them are getting on, but most of them are not on. They still get their news the old way. And, again, I don't know if you can measure the turnout in Wisconsin or Ohio, how much of that is Facebook and how much of that is just what's in the air because of what's going on. There's a lot of that here. So, you know, you couldn't not know what was going on in Columbus. But I don't think that's all coming from the Internet. And if you depend on the Internet, you know, I was very active in the Dean campaign, and we kind of depended on the Internet. And when the chips were down in Iowa, it didn't work. And I think, you know, maybe sometime in the future it will work. But don't forget also that the corporations that have taken control of the mainstream media are looking for ways to take control of the Internet. So that's another area, whether you're right or wrong, we've better deal with that because, again, the main problem here is communication. We are the majority. If you look at the issue by issue, the progressive people of America believe in unions, believe in health care, want to end the war, so on and so forth. We're the majority, but we can't communicate that because we don't have the means of communication. So thanks to you guys for everything you do, you got to do more. Yeah, and so you or Katrina, the people who lead the nation, I ask you to get in touch with some of these other groups that also groups like NAACP and so on, and see if we can't pull together a coalition to move the Democratic Party or after Obama to start another party.
Well, let me come off that real quick, and then we'll try and take one more question, too. But you're so spot on, and believe me, people who know me, if they had just heard me give that little riff about the power of Facebook, they would have laughed because I have not been the biggest believer in new media. I use it all the time. I live on the Internet. But I've also always argued that we have to have, you know, this kind of whole look at traditional media, new media, print, broadcast, digital, all the different vehicles that might work. I only bring the Facebook thing in because I really did see its immense power and the incredible power it has to bring in young people who everybody talks about getting into the process, but who in Wisconsin and to a large extent in Ohio, Michigan, have been a part of this. So I do think that even folks who may think of themselves as older are going to be surprised by how many people are connecting in and how many older folks are doing it. But you're right. And just to give you a sense of my days as this Wisconsin thing took off, you know, there were certain days where I would wake up at 6 in the morning, do a radio show in New York, then get in a car, go and do a studio hit for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, then do Tom Hartman's show and Ed Schultz's show, maybe a local radio show, someplace in the midst of that, write a blog for The Nation, which then, because of the wonderful folks who work at The Nation, not only appeared on The Nation website, but got linked out, you know, to thousands of places. The piece I wrote on Michael Moore in Madison had, you know, I think it was 5,000 Facebook links that came just off our site, and then everything that went off that. And so there was this incredible build-out from there. But then, as things went on, go do a couple more radio things and maybe write something for a newspaper column, and then at night go do Ed Schultz's show. And so to give you just – I don't say that because I was a busy day or something like that. It's to show in that case there kind of touching all of these different media outlets and pieces. And I think you're exactly right. We need to be spending a lot more time figuring out how to, you know, reach people in all the different places where they live. I think The Nation, one of the wonderful things about The Nation and one of the great joys of being associated with it is that I see The Nation for a variety of reasons as sort of an institutional base, as a publication with enough heft, enough strength to kind of elbow its way into a lot of old media. I've been on CNN and MSNBC and even Fox during some of this fight, but also to really work the new media zone and to do stuff in print and digital. And so I'm very excited by the openness of the nation, but also its ability to kind of be in a lot of these places. And I'll close off by saying I do think our caller from Columbus is right, though. Whatever we're doing now is very nascent. It's very beginning of a communication strategy that has to get dramatically better. And the unions are going to have to be central to this because, as battered as they are, they have resources that really don't exist otherwise.
Could I just close it out, unless you want to take one more question, Peg and John? I wanted to speak to caller. I wanted to speak to the good caller, and do not move to France. The nation is strong. We are here. But I wanted to pick up on what John said because he has thought so deeply about the media. But I wanted to also suggest a role the nation has played more and more in these last couple years, which is as a forum for strategic thinking and ideas and connecting movements and their members with ideas and strategies. And humbly say that the ideas in our pages have oxygenated and inspired movements. I'm thinking of, for example, in these last weeks, the emergence of U.S. Uncut, a movement that understands you need to look at corporate tax evasion and target that so that you're not always talking about revenues and balancing budgets on the backs of working people. And I would argue that just with the limited media communication strategy the progressive community has, and let me make clear, we're always trying to coordinate, not just with the media in the progressive community, but with movements and groups out there, that this past tax day, that the debate in this country was far less about Tea Party madness than it was about corporate tax evasion and ensuring that the riches pay their fair share. So I think you're right that we're having, the caller put it, I think, the center-right debate in a center-progressive-left country, and that we need to do more. But I think in our way, with, as John suggested, and he is not an internet evangelist, I promise you, but he saw the power of it on the streets because you need both street heat and the digital heat. But we are working on it, and I take your good question, Mr. Caller, to heart. But I wanted to thank all of you for being on the call today, for supporting the nation's work. And, you know, we're now a media institution. It's the nation, thenation.com, as John spoke to, where we're moving ideas and arguments and activism, driving it into the debate such as it is and always challenging the limits of that debate. And I hope many of you who are new are on the call and have joined recently during our April membership drive. And we welcome you to the Nation family. Hope you'll join us on these periodic calls, members-only conference calls in the future. We're really happy to add 2,000 new associates. We're hoping and happy about the possibility of such by April 30th. We're about halfway there. So if you have friends, not just progressive friends, because as John knows, we're always reaching out in a kind of transpartisan way, and I think there are enormous number of issues right now. Defense budget is one, ending the war in Afghanistan, where you have the ability to make coalitions. So friends, people of conscience, who should be supporting us, and please direct them to donate to donate.thenation.com. donate.thenation.com. And if you have comments or questions, please email associates@thenation.com. That's associates@thenation.com. I'm sorry so many of you couldn't get your questions answered, but John is, if anything, indefatigable. So he may well get to your questions in another form and spirit. And I thank you all for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Well, thank you to everybody. And let me just throw in a powerful, again, a thanks, because I can't tell you the number of Nation associates who've contacted me with emails and notes and just encouragement through this whole thing. And I really had such a powerful sense of the great community that we have built and that we are building. And I've been able to do because we've had this wonderful group of supporters and folks with us through this. So thank you so much for being a part of it.